All right, I think we have switched over. How's the streams?
Get on YouTube for the moment.
Okay, I've got a green light here.
I see YouTube.
I
Twitch
see a
looks good.
notification for YouTube.
Twitch
Okay.
looks good.
Yep, Jim Rai's confirming Twitch is up. Just need a confirmation on YouTube.
Probably need to switch the camera.
Yeah, I see
There we
YouTube. Go on.
Okay, so I guess we're back on.
Yep, I guess we're ready to go. We're going into the news next.
From around the world, what you need to know. Get caught up on News with L. Curtis Boyle.
And now a Muppet News Flash.
Okay. Take it away, Curtis.
Yoki. So the first up, Joel Reiss, who we mentioned last week, is starting a tutorial blog on how to use the C language, and specifically the C language on the Cocoa OS9 C compiler, although it applies to all versions of C, of course. So he was busy this last week. He cranked out episodes 2, 3, and 4, all rapid fire in a week here. So part two, which is what I've got shown on the screen here, is just using getting some typing noise there.
Sorry. Got to
Mark's
mute,
the sound guy,
primarily.
But I don't think he realized that means, you know, don't play sound when not needed.
I mute like 300 times a show.
All right, so the part two here goes into the hello world greet command and kind of explains, you know, how to do that from the C perspective. And then in part three, he gets into character arrays and giving the user a menu to choose from. So how to do some inputs and compares, etc. And then in part four, he goes further into character arrays and character pointer arrays. So getting into the whole, you know, concept of pointers, etc. too. So now he said he's not planning on coming out this rapid fire for the entire series. He just, you know, it happened to work out this week that he could crank out three episodes compared to last week's one. So don't expect him to come this quickly all the time. But for those of you who want to learn C, specifically the OS9 C compiler, it's a pretty good series. Next up, and I think it was Mr. Alan Murphy that notified us of this, that there was a bug fix for the CMOC compiler, version 0.1.69, that actually came out on January 24th, but I missed it. So it's basically a bug fix release from what I gather here. So there's these three main bugs that have been fixed here. So basically, if you guys, anybody's interested in doing programming with the C compiler, and there is an OS9 component to this too, though it also does disk extended basic stuff and works on the Dragon as well. As an example, the AGD from the Spectrum, the actual Spectrum game developer environment actually was written in CMOC, and there's been some card games and stuff written in CMOC. So it's actually pretty popular, especially on the Dragon Cocoa 1 and 2 side. So anybody who's using that, you know, go out and get the update notes there. He actually keeps us up quite up to date and keeps adding to it and libraries and stuff too. So it's if you want to get into C without having to go on OS9, this is an excellent way to do it. Next up, we have Retro Logic Lab, which I think we featured quite a while ago because he did some Cocoa stuff back then. But in this case, he ordered from Ian Maverick from Australia because Ian sells an RS-232 pack clone. And you can order it pre-made, you know, ready to go. You might have to get a 3D print case separately. And you basically give you the RS-232 pack, which you then you can use to drive, you know, like a modem or a serial port or a mouse or whatever. Now, what he did differently here is he specifically ordered it in kit form because he wanted to put the whole thing together himself. So that's exactly what he does. So he goes into a bit of the, you know, what the 6551 is and how it works. And then he has the actual board here. He's got the chips in the package. He's put the ROM in there, and it's got the two alternate exec addresses mentioned there, one for the Cocoa 1.2, one for the Cocoa 3. Now, I will tell you right now, the RS-232 back terminal program is not that good. It's a bare minimum of what you need to communicate, but doesn't have, like, you know, download standards and stuff like that or protocols, so it's not very full-fledged. But it's enough to test it. So anyway, he goes through and does the whole soldering job and then does some, you know, minor test setting stuff back and forth between his little test unit here and his Cocoa there, and you can see the Deluxe R32 pack ROM code running. But basically, he got it up and running basically almost, you know, pretty well first try. So for those of you who are into the fun of soldering, which is absolutely not my forte, that's one way you can get this kit from Ian, or you can order it pre-made and pre-done. And of course, Rick Ulan's working on the 16551, which won't be compatible with disk basic stuff, but you can do some pretty amazingly fast transfers under Nitrous 9. And we will be working on updating those drivers to actually get them going even faster yet for one of the future, probably the Beta 7 release. So next up after that, Robert Sieg in the... I guess I should have put this in the MC10 grouping. Whoops. Basically, he's got the Coco VJ. Now, we showed this a while ago where he actually had to take the cover right off because it won't fit, and he puts the Coco VJ board into the MC10 itself. And now he's doing some hardware trickery where he can almost get two colors into a single character instead of just having black. Now, it doesn't quite scan perfectly, but it's pretty close. You can kind of see it's doing the blue and the red in the same cell. Normally, you can only get a color and black, a single color in that 2x2 cell. So he's found a way to do the timing techniques to kind of fool it. And then theoretically, you can write some programs in assembly language that actually would give you like four or fully controllable colors within those squares on the, and that on the Coco VGA only. That does not work on the standard VGA. Next up, we have a new update again to the SDC up to version 1.25 now. And this is mostly a cosmetic update. So he's got that available for download on the Color Computer Archive, which, of course, Guillaume also runs. But he's got alternate color sets now for the Coco 1 and 2. You can pick between the green and the red, dark red one. But he's also got customization options now for the Coco 3 as well. And also the border colors around each of the boxes for your two halves on each side of the screen. You can custom control that too. And there's a little setup file. You can modify it. And there's some of the new options here. We can, you know, select a composite view of the Coco 3 with alternate color sets. You can change a background color, change a border color, etc. So that's available for download on the archive. Next up after that, Terry Trapp's been rather busy. We showed his Propeller P2 project. Now, some of you hardware guys can probably explain, because I've already forgotten from last week what exactly a Propeller P2 is. But he's got it actually emulating the SID chip from the Commodore 64. That's actually on his P2 board, which he's got hooked up to the Coco. So now he's written a BASIC 09 program that it will send the SID dump file to the P2 with it and plays it out, you know, as if it was a SID chip, which gets some pretty awesome results for those of you who are familiar with the SID chip.
Okay, guys. So an update on Propeller P2 project on the Tandy Killer Computer 3. So I have written a BASIC 09 program that reads a SID dump file and sends it through some addresses I have on the cartridge port over to the P2. And that SID data goes into SIDCOG, and it will now play a tune for us. This is a tune called Puppets. And we may or may not have one of the first SIDs ever attached to a color computer. Who knows? I'm sure someone's done it.
I won't play the whole thing, but really interesting project. And then he put out a couple other demo videos doing some specific songs on it as well. The second one I won't bother playing, I'll just mention it here, is just a different song called Castle. And then the third one he did, he actually gets into a bit more of the technical details of how the whole thing works. So this is a pretty interesting one. Plus, he has some extra songs added onto this one, too. So he plays a song, and I'm glad Rick Adams isn't on this one, because it contains a song theme music from The Last Ninja, which, of course, is a sore spot with some people in the Coco community. But he, like I said, he goes into a bit of an... explanation of how the whole SID format works, how the SID chip works itself, how he came up with the software in BASIC 09 to convert it over to the SID itself here. So it goes into a lot more detail. So I will just skip ahead to play a little bit of the music and just can hear what he did here, because the explanation is very interesting, but I don't want to take the show up till you know, forever. Anyway, it's a really interesting project. I'm not too familiar with the propeller board. I don't know if any of you hardware guys on the call know more about it than I do. But it sounds like this SynCore was something that's fairly easy to get.
It's kind of interesting in that it has multiple cores. So imagine you had, you know, 32 basic stamp programmable things to work with. So to make multi-voice music, you've got a different core for each voice. You don't have to sort of program it yourself. So I could see where that chip would be really useful for this kind of project. I'm not an expert at it, but that would be its strong point. It's got a lot of independent cores that you could have do different things and put it all together.
Okay, cool. I know he said that some very complicated, very quick playing ones, he's had a bit of a sync issue. So I gave him a couple of tips to optimize the Basic 9 program because I noticed a few things he did there he didn't have to. We'll have to see if that actually helps or not. Or you can go to assembly, of course, and you know really crank it out. But it definitely sounds impressive. And there's a ton of SID-based. You know, we have a SID player on in software that the Coco 3 has done in the past, done by Remy. I can't remember his real name off the top of my head, from Europe, who's actually done a full, you know, software synthesized version of the SID chip. But that's basically all it can do. You can't do too much else in the background at the same time. This is taking a ton of CPU time, whereas this takes almost nothing. Next up after that, John Linville posted on Facebook that the 2021 edition of the Basic 10 Liner Contest for 8-bit systems only, including the Coco and the Dragon and the MC10, because I think Jim Gehry takes part in this usually every year too, is now open for entries for this year. Rules are posted on the website. Now, this is hosted in Germany, so the directions originally come in German, and then you skip down and you'll get the English version of it here too. There's the multiple categories, same as he has had in the past. There's the category where every line has to be 80 characters or less to fit on an 80-column screen. There's the 120 characters per line. There's a 256 per line. And then there's the final one, which is basically use every trick in the book and screwing around with the basic interpreters and stuff to be able to cram more into a line. So you can get a really, really large 10-line basic program, but it's still technically 10 lines. So if you want to enter the contest, this started taking entries just now in this last week, and the deadline is March 27th. At 6 p.m. CET, and the awards will be handed out on April the 10th. So I know we've had some pretty interesting stuff come out of this in the last couple of years, including some Coco entries and MC10 entries from Jim Gehry and others. So I'm hoping to see some participation from some of our programmer types in the basic language. Next up, I was hoping Ken was actually going to be on the call today, but he did a... looking at his TRS-80 TP10, which I affectionately call a toilet paper roll. I think that's what TP stands for. Printer, which is a thermal printer, and it's a little narrow one. So it's closer to what you would see like in a supermarket or something like that, where you get your receipts on thermal paper. Now, this one actually is a quite an interesting episode of his because he has a new co-host who's, you know, fairly silent, but definitely adds some ambience to the show. So we'll just play a little bit at the beginning here and I'll skip to the end.
Hey there. I'm Ken. That's Tig. This is CRT. Welcome. Welcome to an episode about a printer.
Anyway, I'll skip a little bit ahead here. So the TP10, for those who don't know it, is a little tiny thermal printer. Very small. Now, he did find out one thing interesting. Like, you can't get the narrow roll paper, thermal paper, that easily anymore, but apparently there is a letter-sized version of it that's still for sale that literally, if you cut it exactly in half, actually runs fine on this. So you can actually get new supplies of it, which is kind of cool. So it actually is still a useful thing. And then he does a little demo of it printing at 2x speed because it's not the quickest thing in the world.
I believe there's still thermal fax machines that use the wider format paper.
Yeah, and I think that's what he was buying, and then you cut it in half.
Yeah, cut it in half. Exactly.
Yes. One thing you can see is that it is
also known as slimy fax paper.
And small letters.
I haven't heard that term before. That's cool.
It feels slimy.
Don't leave your document in the sun.
Yeah, don't put it in the hood, like in the, you know, by the windshield in the car when you're driving somewhere for sure.
And don't tape over it with Scotch tape. That won't erase the print.
As you can see, the
that was graphics, my first printer.
It doesn't distinguish between colors. It just prints them all in black and white.
And there he's doing an L list, so he's actually showing it, you know, printing out a listing of his basic program. And then he has Tig come over and kind of expect, you know, kind of check it out.
Approved.
It's being CAT scanned.
And the cat wants to use the printout as a toy.
Not bad.
Oh, he's interested in learning how to...
Till he gets a paper cut on his tongue.
Or his nose. And then too many Cocoa Cat sightings lately, so I thought it's
and retro.
The little rolls that the paper are on, when you're out of the paper, you can take the roll, they just drop them on a tile floor, and cats will play with them for hours.
Oh, okay.
There you have it. A quick look at...
It's pretty good. You got that printer... Go ahead, Mark. Go ahead, Mark.
Sorry, they're cat-approved. Cat-approved printers.
Cat's probably trying to figure out where's the ink.
Yeah. It was pretty cool because he actually got this not really expecting it to work, and it worked pretty well first try out of the box, so that was a good pickup for Ken. Oh, go away. So this was a rather interesting one. And this was found by Rob Inman. So PC Gamer Magazine, which is like a modern magazine, actually did the Untold Hackaday Life of a Guy Who Made Flight Sim 1 for the Radio Shack's Tier City Computer, meaning the color computer, and this is Greg Zumwalt. Now, we've had Greg on the show. We know he's gotten really interested in 3D printing when we did our interview with him. So here he did a 3D animated printed heart for his wife as a Valentine's Day thing. That's the ultimate geekery. But it's actually covered with a little bit of his history here, too, so it's kind of an interesting read. It's not a very long one, but kind of going through the fact that he retired from being a programmer, and now he's more involved in doing the modern 3D printer and stuff, technical stuff, as much as he ever was with programming back in the old days. He's not really retired. He's just no longer making money off of it. It's just he's kept his tech hobby going. I won't play the thing here because I don't have a clue what the copyright stuff is on these guys, but it's a pretty interesting little project and a pretty good little micro history of Greg Zumwalt and a lot of his Cocoa stuff. So definitely worth a read and worth checking out the video. And this is back to Sheldon McDonald again. So other than the fact he's been working on his, you know, scripting language for music playing with multi-voice, he's also been working on his RS-DOS tools program from Windows, and he's added a ton of stuff to it. So he's actually put this announcement on Facebook, and just this morning he's been uploading videos, and he might still be. I haven't checked lately to see if he's added more because he added one at the beginning of the show. But he's putting up tutorial videos for the various parts of it. So this is the original announcement itself that the new RS-DOS tool is available, and you can download it, the link on the Facebook post there, and then I'll switch over to the videos here. So the first one is the disk file utility, and this means you can mount two disk images at once. You can copy files back and forth, rename them, you know, blah 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 type thing. So he has a tutorial on how to use that using disk files and disk images. I won't bother playing the videos here because they're pretty long, but a lot of good information there, especially if you download his utility suite. Next is the disk raw editing feature, where you can actually edit, you know, the directory track and the actual sectors themselves, etc., which is really cool. And then he's also got his function library usage. So this is a whole bunch of functions that are built into the program that you can call into. And he's got a ton of stuff in there. He's got some stuff like, as you notice, the ASM help here on the lower right corner. You can see if like in key display mode, but he also got stuff for like sprites and things too. So he's got a lot of stuff. Or print and stuff there. So he's got a lot of stuff kind of built in, so you don't have to actually write all of your own assembly code from scratch. You can actually use some of the built-in library functions he's got here and create your assembly language programs with that as well. So this is all combined into a kind of a suite, and you can see from the tabs in the start here, or top here, bleh. He's got the RS-DOS disk editor, he's got the raw disk editor, the program editor, which covers basic and assembly language. It'll do tokenization for you or actually automatically assemble a source code you've done on the PC side right onto the disk image, ready to go as a binary. And then he's got some other stuff that he hasn't done his help stuff on yet. So his tutorial video. So it's a really cool project. And I think, I don't know if Nick Marenis is still here. He might have fallen asleep already too, but I know he was fiddling with it a little bit earlier, and he liked some of the disk editing features and being able to import and import and automatically tokenize and detokenize and stuff too. This is from a person, I don't know who this is, DevSWZ. I don't know if that's somebody we know, and I just don't know the name. But he goes into loading Cocoa game files from WAV files from MRPC, which we've kind of talked about a few other times in the show here. But since it's not somebody I know who it is, if it's somebody brand new, it'd be nice to get them kind of, you know, get in contact with the show as well here and, you know, kind of share tips and tricks, et cetera. But basically he goes through and shows how to load in, you know, because he's been trying to get this Panasonic tape deck to work and hasn't been able to get it to work. He's been fiddling with, you know, volume levels and all kinds of stuff and just can't get it to run reliably to load anything or save. And he found out that basically you can hook it up to a PC and just record and play off of a PC and it works fine. Next one up is another one. I don't know who this is, Eli. So he's got a Cocoa 2 in pretty white condition. I'm pretty impressed with that. And then he's got a little tiny Casio portable TV that he hooks it up to.
There you go.
And while it's not the most readable thing of that size, that's probably a good way to make a portable Cocoa. Just get a battery with
that's your, probably that's right. Probably the best way to use one of those little Casio TVs since they can't pick up a signal anymore.
Yeah, because they all have the RF type stuff ready to hook up. No, he doesn't have any impressive software. He just has a print hello world basic, you know, Dota 10 type thing.
Radio so. Shack's variant of Color Computer Basic, so.
I do remember some people in the back in the day made portable Cocos. I think Frank Swigert, the author of Tandy's Little Wonder Books, and he used to make the World of 68 Micros.
We made a hell of a whack of it together.
Yeah. I was just going to mention, like, Rick used to write a column for his magazine there.
Well, yeah, we had a project called the POCO, which was going to be an LCD screen from an old laptop with a Cocoa and a big wad of batteries. And
well, he used to bring that one to Cocoa Fest, too, because he had one in that wooden case. It was also part of a cape.
Yeah, he had a frustration project that was, I'm going to make a portable Cocoa if I got to use a drill and a hammer.
Yeah, which he pretty well
got pretty close.
Did.
Yeah.
But yeah, we set it up at the entranceway to Cocoa Fest there on the main table where you picked up your passes and stuff. I remember they used to use that with a little, I think you had a 5-inch green screen or something built into it and dual floppies. It kind of looked like an Osborne.
Curtis, is that the closest thing that you've seen to like a Ben Heck style portable Cocoa?
This one here or the one we're talking about?
The one you're talking about.
Yeah, except it's much more of a hack job than I think Ben Hex usually.
And then we had an add-on board called the Expander, which just kind of slapped on the side of the motherboard and folded two ports back over the top of it. And it didn't work because I wasn't a very good circuit designer at the time and didn't really understand timing and gate propagation delays and stuff like that. But yeah, it would have been really cool.
Yeah. Anyway, Boat, now that you're back here, actually, I wanted to ask you something because I asked Frodo and he wasn't too sure about it either. So the Pixel Gaiden guys who are on Amigos as well are,
right.
You know, did their one little stream here just kind of going through some Cocoa stuff because they want to do a, you know, a kind of a pick of Cocoa games type thing. Now, what Frodo and I are not too familiar with Pixel Gaiden. So what exactly is their channel devoted to and what would you say about them?
I would say it's sort of a hodgepodge. They do different segments on every show. And one, the Cocoa segment this week is called Six Good Games. And so all three of the hosts go through the library and they pick what they believe to be the best, or at least, you know, not the best necessarily, but just six good games for the system. So that's what Sanction was trying to figure out on his stream was just, you know, what six games am I going to play? So, Curtis, if you were going to pick six games for the Cocoa, you know, your top six games, could you do it? Could you narrow it down to six games?
No, I tried. We've got a few. I mean, you suggested a few, and I've talked to Nick Murray. We actually discussed a little bit when you were gone earlier. Of, you know, some games like, say, Time Bandit and Cash Man and Sailor Man and Donkey King, some of the standard ones. But I tend to try to pick ones that are a bit more original and a bit more off the wall. Like I would pick stuff like Grabber or Phantom Slayer.
Yeah, I think going with the original titles that aren't just ports is the way to go with something like that.
Lancer.
Well, I'm sure Boat would pick Pegasus instead. But yeah, because I mean, everybody's
Pegasus,
seen
yeah.
Like, yeah. Everybody picks the same, you know, arcade ports or official ones like Zaxxon. That was another popular one for the Coco that people were mentioning earlier. But yeah, I like to pick something that's unique to the platform.
I honestly believe Double Back is one of the greatest games for any, you know, any platform of all time. So that would definitely be it for me.
Okay. Anyway, thanks, because I didn't, like I said, Pixel Gaiden's a pretty recent addition to your network too, isn't it?
Yeah. They're our newest addition to the Amigos Retro Gaming Network, and their show is a little bit different because they tend to cover a wider variety of systems. They're sort of a hodgepodge, and they go all the way up to new games too, you know, retro-inspired releases on new platforms and stuff like that. So it's pretty cool that they're taking a look at the Coco, though, this month.
Yeah, I think they also said that they're doing an Atari ST fairly shortly too. Like that's the two next systems they want to cover.
Yeah.
Do you know when that that was one thing I asked Frodo, and he wasn't sure either when they're doing the actual official stream?
They do. They put out that show twice a month, and I can't remember if the Six Good Game feature is going to be on the 1st or the 15th. But if you just subscribe to the Amigos Retro Gaming feed on your podcatcher, you'll be able to catch, you know, either of the two episodes. So that's probably the easiest way to do it, or just search for Pixel Gaiden.
Okay, cool.
Hey, Curtis, what about Dave Shadoff's game that we did a few weeks ago? That one was really good.
Oh, Star Spores. Yeah, that'd be a cool one, too. Like I said, I couldn't narrow it. He was asking me for like three top games or something like that. I was like, I don't have a clue. I couldn't narrow it to three. Plus, my picks are a bit more esoteric. Like, I'd be picking like graphical adventure games and, you know, silly things like that.
So. Well, that's the thing about Star Spores. It was a great game, and it didn't get the attention it deserved back in the day.
Yeah. Yeah, Spectral basically just, you know, put a one-line text blurb, and that was all they mentioned about it.
Yeah.
Cool. Next up, Sloopy, are you still here? Is he still here? Did he?
And with sound now.
He's still on the panel. Okay,
that was the issue. So I'll mute this, and if you want me to fast forward to a particular part here, we'll just do a kind of the Coles Notes version of it, and let people go to the link to watch the full 17 and a half minute presentation. Yes. So this is your video to install and configure the drive wirelessly chip. And this basically gives you drive wire wirelessly on a Coco 1, 2, or 3. It doesn't matter which model you got.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's basically for any of the three models. Unfortunately, when I was designing the board, I only had the Coco 3. So I could only design for that, and there were still some design issues. So this board, the drive wirelessly board, will only fit into a Coco 1 at the moment, and I am selling them. And this shows you how to set them up and use them. It's pretty simple. I mean, as you can see, that anyone who's looked through the video, the majority of the video is just installing the board into the Coco 1. There's not really a whole lot to say about it. I mean, it does it wirelessly. I show how to configure it in both Pi drive wire and in drive wire 4. So.
Now, does this let you go and do direct stuff on the web too, like Telnet and stuff through Mikey's terminal program? Or is it strictly for the drive wire drive protocols?
Well, the thing is that when you buy the drive wirelessly board from me, it comes with one ESP8266-01 module, and it has this ESP link firmware in it that's used for drive wire. I can also include a second ESP link module. ESP8266 with the Xi modem firmware, so that you can actually use it for connecting to Telnet BBSs and such.
Okay. But you have to swap the module between whether you're doing drive wire or the direct connection.
Yes, you have to swap them out. Or if you want, I can do a special configuration build where they're both in there and you have a switch to switch between the two of them.
Oh, okay. Now you'd have to power down for the switchover, I would presume?
No.
Oh, no. Okay.
No. You won't have to power down, but I've actually have both of them in my machine, and I've used the drive wirelessly to load a terminal program and then flip the switch and then use that to go out to connect.
Okay. Copyright 2020 by Sloopy, stolen from Microsoft. I like your splash screen.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I was. So I didn't.
Basically, here you're running pipes off of the wireless drive wire.
Yes. I loaded it from the drive wire.
And no wires.
No wires. Yeah, you can see the top all is off the machine there, which unfortunately is a little high to see it, but it's the board. It's the board that's installed when you see the me do the install.
Okay.
And cool. This is where it's setting up Pi drive wire.
That's Mikey's version of drive wire.
Yeah, because it'll use either one. And it works well with Nick Morenti's games.
Now, if Nick Morenti could just write a decent game, that'd be awesome. But
hey, we can't have everything.
It's a cool project. So is it actually at the point where it's now ready for sale, or are you just finishing the final tweaks, or where are you at with that?
The Drive Wirelessly board is actually for sale for a Coco One only. And they are $15 plus shipping. And I'm hoping that within the month, I will be able to have both the Drive Wirelessly and the other board, the internal Drive Wire boards, available for general sale.
Okay, right, and how about Coco 2 and Coco 3 versions?
That's what I mean for general sale.
So that'll cover all three.
Yeah, versions. Basically they work fine. The issue now is just fitment. Because of the way on the Coco 2 and 3, the PIA chip and the ROM chips are underneath where the keyboard is, I have to make them much lower from sticking up on the system.
Okay. Now, have you had any queries about the Dragon, just for our Dragon friends in the UK, or even Dragons here?
I have not had any inquiries about the Dragon yet. I'm not, from what I understand, the Dragon includes a built-in serial port.
The Dragon 64 does. The Dragon 32 does not. I think it only has a parallel port.
Yeah, because I mean, this is actually connected straight to the. To the Bitbanger port on the PIA chip itself. It actually disconnects the RS-232 port on the back. So okay. If the Dragon uses the same exact pins on the PIA as the Coco, I
wouldn't count on it.
Which I don't think so. I think they changed things around. It wouldn't work. The other big benefit of this board, if you do have a Coco One, drive wire is usually limited to 38.4K baud. This will allow a Coco One to do a full 57.6.
Okay, cool.
But yeah, I mean, anyone has questions for it, they can contact me. But yes, the boards are for sale for the Coco One. And they will be available shortly for the 2 and 3.
Okay. I will mention that Sloopy is actually one of the people logged in the most in Discord, I think. So if you ever have questions, he's almost immediately available.
Yeah, currently I don't have a job, so I'm home twiddling my thumbs and playing with Coco stuff and Atari stuff.
I think you and Boat have discussed that before.
Yes, I've been an Atari person since 1984.
I was 3 years old in 1984.
I was old enough to push on keys. We'll go with that.
So was I.
So that's a really cool project. And as you mentioned, it does increase the speed of a Coco One. Because the internal circuitry on the Bitbanger, they're only limited to 38.4. The Coco 2 actually fixed that up, so we run 57.6. And, of course, in the Coco 3, you can run it up to 115.2. But
yes,
the fact it doesn't require wires and it actually fits inside the case, you're not taking any multi-pack slots with extra hardware or anything else, is actually quite nice.
Yes, it is quite nice. And once the internal drive wire board is ready, it'll be nice because you'll be able to do a complete drive wire setup where you have your Coco 2, 1, 2, or 3 sitting, say, at your TV in your living room, and you'll be able to connect it up to your TV and then be able to use it right there without having to have a bunch of wires and other such things to connect to it.
Yeah, because you don't even require like an SDC or anything, right?
Nope. The only thing it would require is a power and video cable.
But seriously, though, I mean, why would you not want an SDC in any circumstance?
I agree that the SDC does have its place, and it's a very useful thing. And quite honestly, I mean, both boards together are only about $20 cheaper than an SDC without a case.
Right, right.
But the thing is that if you're going to be trying different games and such, this may be the better option, especially if you're constantly trying new things and you're not in a place, you're using your Coco in a place where that the cartridge can get hit or something like that.
Yeah, and the other advantage is, too, of course, you support the full drive wire protocol through this, so you can actually, like you said before, log into a BBS, you know, over the net, which the SDC does absolutely nothing to help you with.
Yes, that's another thing.
The thing that I found is that the Coco SDC and drive wire are extremely complementary, and both together are greater than the sum of their parts. So you can start with drive wire, or you can start with a Coco SDC, but it's really worth making sure that at some point you can do both,
because yeah, and SDC DOS includes ultimate drive flexibility wire
there.
Yeah,
my primary machine will have both once I get an SDC. So
yeah, I agree. The having them both simultaneously, I mean, one that allows you to do mounting discs and stuff on the PC as well as on the SDC. So if you don't want to like power down your Coco and try to swap an SD card to put some new program on it, you can just send it over DriveWire and then copy it to your SDC if you wanted to at that point. But the ability to be able to telnet into something else or running the virtual terminals and stuff like you can in Nitrous 9 with DriveWire 4, that adds a whole new set of features to it. And you're still running, say, a Nitrous 9 boot off of an SDC hard drive image. So gives you the best of both worlds for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know
check out the video. It's a pretty cool video. Go ahead.
I was going to say, this is very reminiscent of the FujiNet project that's going over right now on the Atari computers, which I'm sure you know about. Is there anything that you're working on that would allow you to connect to, say, like a TNFS server or something like that with the drive wire?
That would just require the software to be written.
Yeah.
DriveWire supports TCP. And so, you could write a layer that would probably do that.
Yeah, just waiting for the right person to get on board. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm not, I can't really do a whole lot of software on the Coco because this has a 6502. Hey, specifically a 6502C.
I will mention, I mean, like I've talked about, with Rick, I'm going to try to work on 16550 drivers here because I do have a couple 16550s in my Mega Mini MPI, although I got to get the special cables for it. He didn't have any available at the time I bought it. But I also know Bill's been looking at, doing some, going a bit beyond that with TCP IP and stuff as well through DriveWire or through some of these new network cards that Rick is working on or what Sloopy's working on here. So hopefully we'll finally get to the point of actually having some proper drivers to do that. We do have some other projects. Like I know Lord Dragon, Todd Wallace, has actually got an IRC client for the Coco just about completely finished that will run through DriveWire and should run through one of these as well, one of these other network solutions. So we should be starting to get some of the connectivity. Back in the old days, back in the 80s, we had K9Q, which was kind of originally designed for ham radio, but it did support like FTP, SMTP protocol for mail and a few other features too, but it had to run through a serial port with SLIP, which basically is not used anywhere anymore. So it doesn't really work with anything. And we don't have the source code, as far as I know, to try to recreate it for the new hardware. So this will be a way to kind of start fresh and new with modern networking protocols. Next up, we have from Jamie Cho. And this is the first of our three MC10 stories that I actually put in the right spot for the new way we're splitting these apart. I did have another MC10 when I snuck in early because I totally misread what my notes said. So anyway, he's put up a post showing that he's using GitHub Actions, and I'm not super familiar with GitHub stuff, so I don't know exactly what GitHub Actions is. So hopefully one of you guys can chime in on that. To automatically generate version releases for MC10 programs using that new MC Basic compiler from Greg Dion that Jim Gary's been using on the games we were demonstrating earlier. And he's got some sample code and stuff on how to do that here, so you can actually do the auto update. Now, for any of you guys that are more familiar with GitHub than I am, what exactly is GitHub Actions? Is that like a scripting language, or what exactly is it? If anybody even knows what that is.
GitHub is a basically a source.
Well, it's a versioning control.
Yeah,
version control. It's a repository.
It's a repository.
Yeah.
No, I know what GitHub is. I don't know what GitHub Actions is. That's a new one on me. Because he's created a demo for it, but like I said, I'm not really sure.
It sounds, I have not looked at it, but it sounds like a continuous integration part where you, whenever you commit something to your GitHub repo, it then triggers a sequence of events like a checker, such as Jenkins or something like that, that can check your code out. And in this case, it sounds like what he's doing is having it create release versions that go through that compiler. So in other words, he's added the MC Basic compiler as an action that GitHub can perform on committed code changes. So you update your MC10 program, you push it up to GitHub. GitHub goes ahead and compiles it for you using that MC Basic compiler and gives it a new version number so that you can track your release.
Now, would that be pushed out to people that are, say, subscribed to that particular program in GitHub?
Correct. They could either download it as a tagged option or get notified depending on their GitHub settings.
Okay. Well, that's pretty cool then. Cool. But I mean, I don't see why that wouldn't work with some other projects Koku related to on GitHub, because there's Nitrous 9 and stuff.
If you describe CMOC or LWASM or anything like that, you can use these continuous integration type features to start triggering workflows.
Okay, cool. Next, MC10, also by Jamie Cho. So he's created a small utility that converts the MC10.c10 files, which is their custom cassette format, to the corresponding .bass files for editing. So this will take the actual data structure of the tape file itself and then extract the programs within the tape file out. So you can use this to de-tokenize a pack tokenized basic program. It actually will create the source code listing in basic for you straight off of that cassette image. And he gives some samples here. You can go download it here on Git, and he's got the usage options here as well. So that's a pretty interesting utility. It saves you the time of having to fire up the emulator, extract it out manually there, and save it to disk. You don't need to touch the emulator at all. You can just rip it right out. So that's pretty cool. So if any of you people interested in doing MC10 development, that's maybe an excellent utility to have. Next up from Jim Gary. Now, this is a program that's been out since 2004 by P. Lapierre. And Jim Gary pointed this out, and I had not heard of this before, so I thought I'd mention it here. There's a disassembler for the 4K Alice and 4K MC10, so it doesn't even need the memory expansion. And it's actually written in assembly itself, and it'll actually disassemble 6803 code. And, of course, if you have one of the memory upgrades, obviously you can do larger programs, et cetera, here too. But the fact that it actually runs in the original 4K is kind of cool. And he shows a sample screen here of some disassembled code. So any of you who want to learn how Lost Valley Pinball works, or the Pac-Man clone, or Flaggenbird, or something like that, that's a pretty good utility to have. And then the last one here is a Dragon related one. So actually, Stevie was mentioning earlier about the MSX2 upgrade board. So this is Dragon Plus Electronics, and they're actually a hardware manufacturer for some Retro Dragon hardware. We've shown them on before with GoTex, et cetera, for the Dragon. And he's put up this video here. It's demonstrating a Dragon with the MSX2 board, the Dragon RGB output board, the 6-in-1 adapter board with the pull-up resistors to allow more cartridges to be plugged into the cartridge port that are getting squirrely on its timing and stuff. Now, in this case here, he's got that board installed, but he's just got the SCC in. But he does say it runs more reliably because the SCC was giving him a couple of issues. All of these things adapted, and he's running Per Surratt, the author of the AGD Spectrum engine conversion to the Coco and the Dragon, VGM player. And he's got a ton of sample music in this actual video. And apparently the disc image he actually gave to Dragon Plus has actually got over 12 hours of music on it, all running from the Coke SDC. It's also running Pear's DriveWire 4 and SDC extender for Dragon DOS Plus 5. So this, like we were talking about before, supports the SDC and DriveWire simultaneously too. I won't play the whole video because it's like 30 minutes, but again, I'll let him give an explanation here at the beginning what this is, and then I'll demo some of the media.
You'll have seen several times before. And there's the Dragon MSX2 board sitting.
There is a dragon under there somewhere, isn't there?
Underneath that is one of the Dragon.
At what point does the dragon not become a dragon anymore? Is my question.
So see,
well, now you're opening up a can of worms. That's
been all distorted.
Like Coco, one's an Amiga, not an Amiga. That's called poking the dragon.
That's right.
The Dragon Ujima flip board.
So the bear will poke the dragon.
To use two devices at the same time. We've got the Coco SDC. And at the back, we've got one of the uprated Dragon power boards. So the RGB board and the power board are both Phil's design, Phil Harvey Smith's design. MSX board is my development, and the Ujima flip is my development from an original in the 80s by Sutcliffe Electronics. Handy and cheap little device to add additional devices. The CPU adaptable is also made, you know, developed by me, produced in China. It was Darren Atkinson who suspected the pull-ups might have been an issue. So what that adaptable does is it lets us use the Coco SDC much more reliably with additional equipment without the need of an MPI. And we can do that because we're not using ports which clash. So at the moment, the Dragon...
Skip to the technical details. But basically, you had all this stuff running at the same time with some hardware that developed. And here you can see a splash screen of the extender that Per Surratt wrote to enable DriveWire 4 compatibility, plus run the SDC all with Dragon DOS plus 5.0, which is kind of cool. But they've got, you know, basically they're caught up on full support, just like our SDC DOS does as well. And he's using, you know, one of the YM chips here for the sound chip, and he's going to run some music.
7X ports, six, although I must confess I don't remember all of them. The one I'm going to play for you today is, quite frankly, the one that blew me away yesterday when I first heard it, and I quite frankly can't believe I'm hearing this from a dragon. So here we go. I'm going to play Final Fantasy tune, and hopefully it will come out okay for you. Here we go.
Is that loud enough?
Yes.
Sounds good, Curtis. That was very impressive.
One thing, if you go through the video to the Final Fantasy Option 6, it says it's at the bottom, it says Choice 6A. That's because there's sub-songs within that chunk. So the Final Fantasy is actually a whole bunch of clips. Fast forward to some others, you can kind of hear some variety.
More music for Final Fantasy there.
What's that about?
That's more music for Final Fantasy. That's another part of the soundtrack.
Yeah. There's actually, I think there's like 20 or so subsections of Final Fantasy music within that option 6, so it's actually got, it looks like the entire... I'll just skip ahead for different pieces here. Now, I'm not a Final Fantasy wizard by any stretch of the imagination, so, Boat, if you're quite familiar with it, you can even mention like what part of the game.
Let me ask you a question. So, is it what was preventing this kind of music from appearing in Coco games? Was it disk space? Or was it CPU, you know, taxing of the CPU? What was the bigger issue?
Well, the main thing is right now he's using an actual sound chip in here. Okay.
So he's using a piece of hardware that wasn't even present in the Coco.
Yes. Yeah. Okay, this is the MSX 2 Plus board. So it's got the MSX graphics chip, sprite chip, and the sound chip.
Oh, I see. I see.
But he's actually, we've actually been starting to get software support. In fact, that AGD engine we mentioned, which takes that more generic ZX Spectrum engine, which is several hundred games that have been homemade with it. He's actually converting that one over to use the 16 color versions and the sound like this for all 200 games. So those games will get reported again to use that card. It's a pretty good variety of music and some musical tone effects and stuff.
So let me ask you a question, Curtis.
Yep.
So he's basically made a board that has all of these MSX chips in it, and mm-hmm. he's put that board, he's connected it to the Coco board. What would prevent you from doing this with any machine? You know, if I could put a Paula chip, you know, on a board and connect that to the Coco and give it Amiga sound capabilities, I guess, you know, this is just another one of those questions where it's just like, at what point do you cease to think that this is actually a Coco and just not something that's just sucking the life out of the Coco and making it, you know, something else?
Well, that's the eternal question, right? I mean, if you want to be period correct, we did have the sound speech pack, which did have one of the older chips that did, you know, several voices and a noise channel, and some Coco games at the time back in the '80s did support it. And there were some other third-party ones like the Super Voice and a few others there that did things as well.
But they were expensive, and a lot of people bought them.
Well, they also required multi-packs. You couldn't install them on the interior, so you had to buy a multi-pack, right, which is $100, and then buy another $80 card on top of it. By that time, you got the cost of a Coco again.
Right. Well, this is actually two products, though. He's got his expansion device, and then he's got the music card that plugs into his expansion device, so...
Yeah, well, you can buy the music or the music slash graphics card. The MSX 2 Plus board is a separate thing. You can actually just install it by itself too. It's
just kind of like a speech sound pack.
Well, it's a graphics card too, though. It's also got a sprite chip and 16 color graphics modes and stuff like that for a Coco One level machine. But yeah, I mean, Boat's right in the fact that this is retrofitting hardware from outside. Now, what are the limitations of doing this? I'm sure that some hardware interfaces more easily with, say, Intel chips versus, or a Z80 chip versus a 6809 style chip, between, IO port based CPUs versus memory mapped IO. I'm sure there's other ones that are, a bit easier to convert than others. But yeah, I mean, some of this could have been done back in the day if somebody wanted to. I mean, it's like the Mega Mini MPI has an OPL3 chip, which is what the Sound Blaster used. And I've got one of those here too. So, I mean, the problem is now you're fragmenting the market. You get these little custom boards and, this one person can run on this piece of hardware and this other one totally incompatibly does similar features but not the same way. So is any one of these going to win? It's going to be totally dependent on software, who writes drivers and or programs that actually use it. We've got Nick's MP3 card that Dave Veer is also doing a version of an MP3 card for his new game too. So
Curtis, can I throw in real quick? I don't think it's a matter of when at this point, because in the last year, that's been one of my goals with my game port, is to see what it would take to have a platform to give people the option. You can play this game, and if you have this hardware, it will take advantage of it. The way that old DOS games did when you started them, they had a little menu. You have
a Sound Blaster,
use it. If you don't, then you just get beeper sound or whatever.
Yeah.
And so that is possible, but a lot of it is that it takes getting all that information put together in one place. And right now that information is fairly widely scattered out. Each person that makes a card makes their own programming information available for it. And it is there if you go digging, but there's not really a place where you just like, here's everything all at once. There's the Commodore 64, for example, had a programmer's reference guide that detailed every chip, several languages, the schematic, all of that at once in one book. It was a third-party book, but it was widely available. There's really not quite the same for the Coco. There's a schematic in one book, a memory map in another book, this one sound card, you go to this blog post to find the information of it. This other sound card, you go to a Google Drive, you know, and so collecting all that up is a pretty serious initial hurdle. So yeah. One of the things that I tried to do is put that all together on my webpage and post example code in the Discord sound channels so that you can go into those sound channels and there's a pinned message that says, here is a sample that plays the 12-note scale on this card. And here's another sample that plays the same 12-note scale on that card and on this card. And so that gives other programmers at least a starting point to say, oh, okay, here's at least something I can look at on how to get into that sound chip and this sound chip and the others.
Yeah,
right. And what I'd like to see is these programmers working with people like Nick Marantes and saying, you know, let's put a screen up at the beginning of the game and say, before you go on, I must know, you know, do you have this? Do you have that? And then choose your, you know, push 1, 2, and 3. It doesn't seem like it would be that hard.
That does. I have seen that happening more and more in things like Facebook posts or in Discord channels or the mailing list is that, you know, someone says, hey, I got an idea for a piece of hardware, and a whole bunch of other people show up. Oh, here, I could do this and that and the other. The Coco Nick and the Coco IO would be a good example of that here recently, as well as Boise's Ghidra network project, you know, but part of it is there has been a historical reluctance to announce your project early to avoid having someone else swoop it out from under you, which it used to happen. I don't know so much now, but that is a concern that people have when they're developing hardware that, oh, you know, if I do this, someone else is going to do something similar and steal my thunder. And so you end up with everybody playing secreted, which is a walled garden and keeps developers from finding out about it until basically the last day. So then the hardware exists, software doesn't, and you end up in that catch-22.
Yeah. It's a vicious circle where nobody's making programs for the hardware and the hardware is dying because nobody's making programs for it.
Yeah. And to be honest, I mean, Nick Marenti is one of the people that would probably point this out too. Like he's a single man operation. Does he have enough time in his own mind for what he wants to put in the effort for a game or whatever? Does he want to try to support 8 different sound cards, especially if some of them are programmed totally different from each other? And his answer for his particular case is no, he doesn't want to spend that much time. He wants something that is very common. Like it took me 25 years to convince him to use a 6 through 9, even though there were several thousand Coco systems out there with it, even from the 90s. Because he figured that was not a big enough market for him.
Everybody wants to program to everybody wants to cast the widest net. They want to go to the lowest common denominator, and it's hard to change that opinion.
Yeah, I mean that's one thing I think Rick, Yulin, myself, Bill Noble, and a few others, we are kind of starting to design an API system for Nitrous 9 because you can abstract hardware more easily on that platform, so we can make a generic sound driver set of calls, but you'll have an individual driver you install for whatever card, but that means you can send the same programming no matter what card you have and it'll produce results. And we're planning on trying to get something that will support the at bare minimum 3 voice simultaneous sound. Maybe you would do a query of the card and go, do you have extra capabilities I should know about? And then you might have to custom program some things, but you get something that would work with a sound speech pack and a Game Master cartridge and an OPL3 chip and the MSX2 Plus and a few others, because all of them have a bare minimum capability of a 3-voice, 1-noise channel. And if we write a driver properly enough that you just send it sequences meant for 3 voices, and internally that driver translates it to whatever specific hardware you're running, then the game programmers using that under Nitrous 9 would only have to write the program once and not even have to worry about which hardware you have. They just have to know the driver's been written for it. And we're hoping to go that route so that it becomes much easier for programmers to use this kind of hardware. So hopefully in the future we'll see that happen. Just same as the 16550s and stuff too. Like there's multiple people working on 16550s. There's one in the Mega Mini. Rick's including it on his, Ethernet/16550 board. Anybody who still has his older 16550s, Paul Barton's done stuff with 16550s as well on his NOCAN boards, et cetera. So if we can get one common driver that works with all those, we'll suddenly get really high buffered, high speed serial port stuff going too, which might help with, you know, some web access, et cetera. Or even transferring directly to a PC or whatever as well. So a lot of the hardware abstraction at the software API level is something we're trying to shoot for. That's what OS 9 was designed to be around. That's why you just install a device driver. Oh, I got a SCSI drive. Oh, I got an IDE drive. Oh, I got a SASE drive or whatever, then, you know, it just works. As far as the programs go, it just calls a drive DD and it doesn't really care, you know, what the hardware is underneath of it. And that's the way it should be done. But that's a bit harder with just BASIC because it wasn't really designed for that in mind.
Well, and the last piece on the hardware versus software, why is there this, that, or the other, is also there is some misperception. Because when I did a roundup of the stuff that works just with the TI chip that's in the Game Master cartridge, turns out there's a lot more out there that you can find and uncover. There's been a lot more for the speech sound cartridge. You know, so when you take a quick look, it seems like there's not a lot of support for any particular device. But the further you get into it, the further you find there's actually more about it. And I, some of the stuff that I found, even the people that built the cards didn't know that that particular add-on or piece of software was available. So in a sense, there is more out there than it looks like for each of the hardware options.
Yeah, it's just a matter of finding it and amalgamating it.
Just that there's not like there's not like a central push to advertise it. So each person works the project as they feel, and it ends up in whatever state it ends up as they feel, and they advertise it in the places that they like or not. But, you know, eventually there might be one mailing post, there might be one Facebook post, you know, there's one screenshot somewhere that you run across it, and you find it, and you add it to the collection for that same thing. And then by the time you're done getting ready to program it, turns out there's 10 different games that use the Game Master cartridge.
Now, yeah, I mean, the top two would be the sound speech pack, because obviously that was Tandy sold, so there was quite a few third-party games and
Tandy games. There's a pile of stuff for the sound speech pack.
Yeah, Game Master's probably second, I'd say. Or the Orknetty didn't really get used for games too much. I mean, John Strong did, and it's not really
John Strong did, but a lot of people didn't know that either. Yeah. So, you know, there is more support out there that people may not be aware of. So that's another thing that we probably ought to kind of try to promote within the community, is that, hey, there is good reason to get interested in these devices if you haven't been before, because there's more support that you may not know about. And that's where I like the Discord channels for trying to keep up with each card, because you have a collection point for that one information. Alan Huffman has a wiki site that's real good for that. And there's a couple of GitHub lists of things. And Stevie's got the I'm a Coconut site. You know, that you know, we just got to get the word out that there is actually all this stuff out there.
Yeah. The other thing we have to do, too, I think, that would help centralize this somewhat, is we need patches to BASIC, like this BASIC, not OS 9, BASIC 9, et cetera, but patches to BASIC to use this kind of stuff. Alan had started that at one point, and I think somebody else had tried starting it, too, but they never really finished it. Like, we need some sort of interface to the play command that actually talks to the cards instead of just the built-in 6-bit DAC.
Well, Jeremy Spiller did Super Play back in the Rainbow, and I had no idea about it until I went searching through all of the music software that had been published in Rainbow and what it was for, and I ran across this little driver that extended the play command to work with the Orc 90 and four voice music and everything else, and you just write it as play in your BASIC. And that kind of stuff, you know, we need to kind of get that awareness up as well. You know,
we need to patch it to handle the hardware cards too. Yeah. Like the other ones, I mean, the more modern ones.
Uh-oh, Mark's cracking the whip.
What were we in the news segment?
That was the last news, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was the last one. So,
and we were having new commentary, Mark.
Yeah, it morphed into the commentary. Okay,
Actually wake you up? I'm sorry.
Yeah, I came up from my nap for a bit.
No, it's a fascinating subject. I know, like, a few of us, Alan Huffman, John Strong, and a few others, have discussed as at CocoaFest the last couple of years that we really need to come with a standard API, whether it's in DiskBASIC or OS 9 or both, where you can write code once, but everybody uses the same code, and you send it to this driver, whether it's a separate program in DiskBASIC that patches the play command, or it's a Nitrous 9 driver, or whatever, so that the game writers and stuff only have to write the code once, and they don't have to worry about what sound card you have, but it'll take advantage of it as much as it can. And run in the background, that's the big thing, because right now, most of the stuff is written for the 6-bit DAC, and the CPU has to keep it up. It has to switch, you know, pushing the speaker in and out manually to, you know, generate sound waves. which is a very CPU intensive. So you really want to have these, you know, sounds where you just say, go play this note for the next half a second and I'll come back to you when I'm, you know, ready for the next note, as opposed to
Simon,
you know, oscillate the speaker 14,000 times a second, which is a lot more CPU intensive.
Simon's the guy on how to fix that.
You mean for DisBASIC, you mean, or?
Just for much more efficient, even 6-bit DAC code.
Well, no, I mean, we've had a few. It's not just Simon that's able to do the efficient 6-bit DAC. I mean, Jeremy Spiller and a few others have done it in the past, too. Like, if you listen to, or Jeff Steidel, who did, you know, the Contras one, because that's using digitized sound effects 3-channel at once, too, while doing hardware scrolling and, you know, playing Contras type of thing. So we've had those software routines before, but if you can do it on the sound chip, you still take like 50% of your CPU time just doing sound, which is why some of the games on the Coco can't match what some of the ones that had sound chips do, because it's taking so much CPU time just doing the sound in the background. Whereas on these sound chips, it's basically you send stuff maybe once every 60th of a second or something, as opposed to, you know, you're constantly hammering on the DAC port. So you would see games that you cannot possibly do with full sound effects and full music if you use a hardware sound card or sound chip versus doing it totally through software.
Well, we need to extend the play statement then and have the music macro language be at least a starting point for the Deck B side, so that all the basic games can be expanded right up front.
Yeah, and even the same ones. I mean, if you have a basic and it's just a ROM call and you just tell it, go play this in the background, because it'll send it to the sound card or the sound chip, and the chip itself's doing the playing, the Coco can come back and move graphics around and move sprites and fire bullets.
Curtis, has there been any interest within the community of people actually wanting to go back through the back catalog and adding these commands and being able to, you know, expand games that have already been released with things like background music and additional sound effects?
There has been some talk on ones that use common engines. I'll give you one example that actually I might become personally involved with, and that's the Sierra games. Because right now it has its own custom sound routine to smooth out the waveforms from what NOS 9 would normally do, but it's still single voice. And of course, the original King's Quest games all had multi-voice, like on the Tandy 1000, for example, or the IBM PC Junior. Now, those, I believe the data structures are still there for the multi-voice. They're just not used. It just takes the melody note and just uses that on the Coco. So if we rewrote that, for example, to use the Sound Speech Pack chip or Game Master or whatever, or some generic driver, you should be able to patch those so that all of a sudden all of the Sierra games suddenly have all their multi-voice music back and don't slow down the CPU at the same time where it's just playing music and not updating graphics. So there is some talk on some for doing that.
Does someone have a TV going in the background?
Yeah, I'm hearing something too.
Yes.
Uh-oh. Guess who?
Anyway, that was the end of the news. So it's been a pretty busy news week. Some pretty cool stuff going on. And some comments in the chat here on this thing here, too. Henry Garner says, if you're going to expand the play command, I recommend also adding a command that allows you to change the wave shape and perhaps even the ADSR envelope. I think there are some versions of Microsoft Basic.
SuperPlay does that.
Yeah. Actually, GraphExpress by Jeff Seidel from Zundog also allowed you to do that too. On its, and that's also another thing you can plug into BASIC and have it run in the background. He also mentioned that the experience with the Orchestra 90 was in Model 3. Rob Inman mentions about... no, he's complaining about Jim not having the Mega Mini MPI. I've got one here. It works fine. And that's not a prototype. That's an actual for sale. The thing is, complaints. With Zipster, he's got so many products, and he can only do two or three at once, so he rotates them through. Mega Mini's not a huge seller for him. That's more the Mini MPI, because basically people just want to be able to run like two cards. So that one only gets recycled like every 6 months, and you have to catch it when the next 10 boards get made, which are sold out in 2 days, and then you have to wait another 6 months. And I think Rob's just kind of mad because he never gets, you know, in on time on those things. So
David Ladd is angry because he said you only need two slots.
You need 10, maybe 12.
12.
He thinks you need at least two Mega MPIs plugged in together, I think is what he needs.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's an interesting subject, and there's some work on taking something as a standard engine to try to do something, and the general Nitrous 9 bit here, which I'll hopefully be involved with in actually creating a generic set of APIs that can call any particular hardware sound card and use the features on it. So,
all right. Sound man.
So what's next on our list?
I think we went through everything.
Yeah, the only other thing I think that Steve had mentioned was to go over his very first Coco stream, but I think we've gone long.
No.
We can probably wait till next week.
No. We should do that when he's here anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right.
We've gone long enough.
We're ready to do the outro then?
Yes.
Yep, yeah. If there's any final thoughts after that, we can gather those up while we're playing the outro.
Okay. Now, this is a new outro that he has modified or he's redone.
Yes, yeah. Sir.
See it then.
This concludes another episode of Coco Talk, the world's leading live talk show featuring the Tandy Color Computer. For all things Coco Talk, visit us on the web at cocotalk.live. We'd love to hear from you. Send feedback, suggestions, even segments via email to cocotalk@cocotalk.live. Consider supporting the show with a purchase of merchandise from our retro swag shop at 8bit256.com. If you'd like to become a patron of the show, click on the Patreon link on our website, cocotalk.live. Coco Talk would not exist without the community, its cast, crew, and contributors. Thanks go to Alan Murphy, Bill Noble, Brian Joyce, Brian Weisler, Curtis Boyle, D. Bruce Moore, Danny O'Connor, David Ladd, Eric Canales, Grant Leedy, James Diffendaffer, Jason Reichert, Jim Brain, Ken Reichert, Mark Bosley, Mark Overholzer, Mikey Furman, Mr. Dave 6309, Nick Marentes, Nick Marotta, Nick Marotta, Nick Marotta, Paul Fiscarelli, Richard Lorbieski, Rick Adams, Rick Eulin, Rob Inman, Ron Delvaux, Samuel Gimes, Sloopy Malibu, Steve Bjork, Terry Steggy, Tom C., and many more. Please help support the Coco community. A list of various contributors and resources are available at imacoconut.com. That's imacoconut.com. The original Coco Talk theme song is copyright 2008 by D. Bruce Moore and Greg Sheeler. The new Coco Talk theme song is copyright 2020 by D. Bruce Moore. Both are mixed, mastered, and produced by D. Bruce Moore. Coco forever, people!
Okay, final thoughts.
Long show. That's my final thought every week.
I could probably get 3 or 4 more hours. I don't.
Oh, okay. Well, let's go for it then. Go find some more news.
It wouldn't be the first time we've took a break, come back, and did another few more hours.
That's true.
Never before.
One thing I would like to discuss, because I know we've kind of been warned in Canada that international travel probably won't be until May, which means Coco Fest might be out for any of us Canucks. Have you guys heard, or anybody on the panel here heard about whether or not it sounds like it's going to actually go through in April like they're originally planning?
They're not going
to start planning for Virtual Fest again.
They're going to talk about it this coming meeting.
Yeah, I was going to say it's this next meeting that they're discussing whether or not they're going to have to postpone it or not.
Okay.
I guess the venue, they have like a backup date of in September that they can push back.
Oh, okay. Well, that'd be good. That sounds more realistic to me.
Right.
It's looking more and more like that. It's going to be more realistic. So.
Yeah, for me, I won't be able to make it until after I get my shots because of restrictions I've got. So,
because of the risk you have, right?
Well, no, I'm also a caregiver and some of the facilities that my brother has.
Right. Just like me. My mom's 88.
Yeah, so... till I can get the shots, then that restriction gets lifted on me for traveling.
Yeah, so I think realistically, I think we'll probably have to do a virtual fest. So I guess anybody who has presentations or things that we're planning for the fest for the last week of April there, we should start working on the virtual versions of it like we did. That was pretty successful this last year when we did it.
That's
I thought that
cool.
actually went amazingly well.
Oh, it went very well. One of our best watched shows ever.
Yeah. People actually stayed awake the whole way through, too, which is rare.
6 hours also.
Yeah, because it didn't feel like 6 hours because it just moved right along.
Yeah,
right along.
Some of the presentations were rushed because we were thinking we were going to run out of time for other people here. Yeah, it was a good show. I'd probably say for the last year, that's probably the show I'm the most proud of, to be honest. Because that was good.
Jim says I caution against pushing the revised date just yet.
Yeah, nothing's official yet.
Yeah, I'm not saying like you guys said, the next meeting is going to kind of determine it, but. I can say from the point of view of the Canadian government here, I don't think you'll see any of us Canucks down there if it's on April. Just, you know.
Well, have you got a tunnel dug yet?
Wrong border.
Has CocoFest always been in – has CocoFest always been in April? Is that just like the month of CocoFest?
Yeah.
April, May. It depends.
Yeah. Wouldn't it used to be later and then it moved into spring to –
get away from
it's
the
been,
other ones?
I think there's even been one or two in late March, once or twice. And then otherwise it's been April or May, depending on. And that was Rainbow Fest as well, not just CocoFest.
March was a disaster because the cheerleader conventions and everything else were going on. So.
Yeah, it was way too distracting for us nerds.
right?
Okay.
Yeah, like for me, back in the old days, March for me was completely out of it because we were still in the middle of baseball season for ticketing, so there was no way I'd ever make it in March. So there was a few I missed, even back in the day.
You know, something that we lack that probably all of us should show is our pocket protectors.
I've never had one.
Me
I've
either.
Had, I've had yeah, ink leak in my shirt before, but I've never had a pocket protector.
Or pom poms
accepted as well.
How about pom poms for the cheerleading conventions?
Well, I do remember the Rainbow Fest. The first one I went to in 1986 in Chicago, the Hyatt Regency, was the same year. I think the Chicago Bears had won the division champion or the Super Bowl or something like that, and they actually had their party at the exact same hotel at the exact same time. So they're watching like, the refrigerator and stuff, you know, wandering by.
There was probably a lot of overlap there between the Coco crew.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they came in to play Zaxxon with the rest of us. But,
yeah, right.
But, I mean, they had, you know, arm candy on every single football player, one on each arm type thing. So that was kind of an interesting distraction from the show. And, man, did they drink like fish. Holy cow.
How common is arm candy at Coco Fest?
Well, if you mean literal candy, it's fairly common. You get a bucket of M&M's stuck on your shoulder or something like that.
Especially if you can get your hands on Canadian chocolate bars.
Yeah, which I usually bring. The last couple years have been kind of a tradition for me to bring a bunch of the flavored Kit Kats you guys don't get in the States.
Oh, and some of them were so good.
What was your favorite, David? That's my question.
All of them. I'm sorry, Nestle sucks in the United States for chocolate bars.
All sugar, no chocolate.
Yeah, because we had, what did I bring down? I can't remember. I had like salted caramel.
Caramel, yeah. And there was
orange.
Like that chocolate.
There's a mint one. I didn't bring the green tea one because that one was gross even up here. White chocolate.
Orange. There was some with orange, like the ones you get at Christmas time.
There was a
we had mint ones.
Tiramisu was another one. There was a bunch of them.
Too bad we can't get a Kogo in the form of a candy bar. You know,
what's a Kogo? I'm not sure that.
No, chocolate bar that looks like a Kogo.
You know, one of those 5-pound chocolate bars.
It would look cool.
You could probably get someone to make a mold and start stamping some out.
They have the food 3D printers now. Can you use that for chocolate?
Oh, probably could, huh? Chocolate printer. Like it.
Yeah.
You're going to have to put your lips on the the thing that makes it come out and stuck on it to get it to work.
Yeah, I'd never finish a 3D print because I'd eat the damn thing halfway through.
No, you wouldn't. And of course, you wouldn't want to even try to eat the chocolate as it comes out of the hot nozzle. You'd probably end. Burn yourself.
Well, that would be fine.
Oh boy, here we go. Can push the button, Frank, quick.
I think the fact we're all talking about food means that we're probably getting hungry for something.
Put up the After Dark logo now.
All right.
All right. Say goodbye, everybody.
Bye, everybody.
Bye, everybody. Bye, everybody. Bye, everybody.